Ever wondered what powers the world of your favorite superheroes? Dive into Understanding Superhero Comic Books, the definitive guide that unravels the mystery. It plunges into the captivating world of spandex, superpowers, and the masterminds who conceive them. Trace the origins and evolution of superhero comics, fueled by influences from Bela Lugosi's enigmatic charm, Errol Flynn's daring exploits, and the early mesmerizing magicians. Witness Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, and more as they navigate societal shifts, reflecting our world within their epic tales. Buy Alex Grand's Understanding Superhero Comic Books, available now.
Welcome back to the Comic Book Historians Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Grant. Today we have another installment in the David Armstrong interview series, part one of two of the Nick Carty interviews. Now, David Armstrong interviewed Nick Carty first in 1998 over at San Diego Comic-Con on set, and then a second time in 2005. In this one, he discusses working at the Eisner-Niger shop, his influences like Gary Cooper, Noel Sickles, working at Fiction House, getting drafted into the Army, Tarzan, Casey Ruggles, how he entered DC Comics, and then also his interactions and observations about Alex Toth, Jack Kirby, Neil Adams, Mike Sikowski, and working with Julie Schwartz and Carmine Infantino, and later working in animation, illustration, and movie posters for New Line Cinema. Thanks to David Armstrong and his foresight, we're able to enjoy these interviews that I was very excited to edit into podcast format. All right, David, take it away.
Where were you born?
Well, I was born, you want me in New York City?
Yeah.
Well, that's where I was born, yeah. And I was raised there. It was during the Depression.
Were your parents, where were they born?
They were born in Italy. They came over about 4 or 5 years before I, you know, was born. My brother and sisters were born there, see, so.
And what did your father do for a living?
Oh, he was a plain laborer, you know. In those days, you couldn't get jobs. There was WPA, bread lines, all that sort of thing.
How'd you start drawing?
When I went to junior high school, anyone knew that I'd draw, the teachers that were the art teachers would push me. In one class at junior high, they had me and another student do a 4x8 mural. And he did one side and I did the other side. And they had it published in the Herald New York World then. It was gone, but they had a big page spread on both these murals, you see. And I was only about 14. And it was great. And then while I was in school, the art teacher gave me books to read, and that's where I discovered Michelangelo and all these artists. But then I went to a boys' club. See, this was in New York City. I went to a boys' club. They had an art class there, and I was taking lessons there. And while I was painting there, they had someone come in from the Literary Digest magazine, and they took a photograph of the painting, and they wrote an article about that in there. See, so it was just a progression type thing. See, so.
Did you have formal training?
No, because at that time, we were just barely getting enough food on the table, and they couldn't afford to pay for a college or anything like that, see, so.
So what was your first professional work? What did you get paid for?
My first published piece of work was with the Eisner and Iger studio. I was at that studio for a little while. I was getting $18 a week. And when I got in there, he said, come in. He says, we have the drawing table, but we don't have the tabarets, you know, the part where you put the inks and everything. And he said, you go to a grocery store back there. You look in their back and you get an orange crate. So you put your ink on that and you put your stuff, you know, on top. And he said, because we're expecting new tabarets, you see. And then when I went in and met the fellows and I saw all these dirty orange crates, I know that they've been there a lot longer, so the orange crates. One time he came up to me, he said, Nick, he says, you look in your pay envelope this week. You got a surprise for you. And I got a 50 cents raise, you see. So that was a big a big deal.
How'd you get work at the Eisner shop? How'd you hear about it?
Eisner was doing The Spirit and Lady Luck and Mr. Mystic. It was a little supplement that they put in the papers. And the guy that was doing Chuck Mazuzin was doing the Lady Luck before me, but he got drafted. They got me from the bullpen, and that's where I got doing Lady Luck. I think I was getting $25 a week or something like that. See, those
are pretty good money in those days.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I wanted to be an illustrator. And if you wanted to be an illustrator, you couldn't go out. You needed agents and things like that. So the best way to start was from the comics going up.
Who were your favorite illustrators?
Oh, in those days, I had so many. The people that influenced me in design were like Degas, some of the Impressionists, and some of the classic Renaissance artists for construction. But then when you got to the illustrators, then you got to the polished stuff that sells. Oh, let's see, I had Robert Fawcett, Al Parker, Johnny Whitcomb. They influenced me. When I was at the boys' club, after the end of the year, they had a lot of these boys exhibit their work, and they rented a store near the plaza on Fifth Avenue in New York City. I was sitting in a window with another artist with my back toward the window, and we were sketching from the models, some debutantes that were posing, see. Who was standing in back of me was Gary Cooper watching. And he looked at me and winked. I found out later on that he was a cartoonist. He liked to do cartooning, see. So anyway, the debutantes spotted him, and he took off. The models got off the stand, and they took off after him, see. And, well, years went by, and I was at the Iger studio. And as I was coming in from lunch, who was waiting for the elevator but Gary Cooper? And I said, I don't know if you remember me. I was an artist. I was drawing on 50. He said, oh, I remember. You were the kid in the window. See? And he remembered. And so we were chatting, and he said, write to me. And just then the elevator doors opened, and the girls and a couple of guys from the Iger studio, because I was a kid then. Iger had a way of parading some beautiful models or something inside. And they always ignored me. But when the door opened and Gary Cooper shook my hand, he said, be in touch. I just floated. And that was a moment because nobody ever rubbed off on me like that. You know?
Did you ever keep up with him? Did you ever get
No, I never did write. My family used to get after me for writing, you know, but I'm sorry I didn't, because he was a hella nice guy. And I know he went in Chicago or somewhere around there to learn cartooning or art drawing. See? That's while I was doing the Lady Luck strip.
How long did you work at the Iger shop before you ended up doing the Lady Luck strip?
I don't know. Maybe a year or so.
You were working for the Eisner shop before you went into service?
No. After Eisner, I went to work for Fiction House. And I did a feature called Camilla and a few of these other things.
When you were at Fiction House, did you meet some of the other artists that were working there?
I can't remember the ones off the bat.
Did you see many of those guys socially, or did you just do your work and go home, and that was it?
Yeah, that was it. Going home, because they scattered all. One may live out in Long Island. One may live in Brooklyn, and you see. So I was in Manhattan, so we all went out different directions. No, we didn't socialize too much. I got drafted, and I went to the 66th Division, which was in Florida. I went through all basic training. They had a competition to see who can draw an emblem for their division. And I won out, and I did a panther. I don't know if you ever saw a panther division. Well, I did that for them. And then while I was in the infantry, I did some drawings for the club, officers' clubs. And after a while, what happened was that the general, they have so many divisions in a corps. Well, the big cheese general came down. He saw the drawings. He says, I want him. So they wanted to transfer me to Texas. Meantime, I had been doing portraits of the general, you know, in charcoal and stuff like that. And he said, well, we can't send you as a first-class private. He says, we'll get a rating. So they found out what rating was open. So the rating that was open was in the motor pool. So then when they sent me to Texas, I got there. All these people were packing to go to the Pacific. And the guy looked at me and says, who are you? I says, I was sent for. He says, well, what do you do? I says, well, I'm an artist. He says, well, we don't need any artists. He says, could you do lettering on a duffel bag or something? I said, I don't know anything about lettering. They said, oh, you're in the motor pool. And they assigned me to a tank. I said, I don't even know how to drive a truck. He says, don't worry, we'll teach you. So if you ever see any buildings in Europe that had their corners torn off, that was my driving, you see.
When did you get out of service?
Between 45 and 46, around there. Service, I decided to do some illustration. See, I did a lot of army sketches. I have those, you know, and some paintings. But then I started doing magazine covers in color, full color. And while I was doing that, I was making samples. The money wasn't coming in. So someone asked me to do the Tarzan Daily strip. Bern Hogarth called me and said, would you work? So I worked on that for a year, on Tarzan Daily strips. And then there was another strip called Casey Ruggles. And I worked on that. That guy was a fine artist, but his work was like Alex Raymond.
Warren Tufts.
Yeah, Warren Tufts. He was great. I did that for, I don't know how many, a week. I don't know if it's a week, a couple of weeks.
So. Did you get a kick out of doing a daily strip?
When a guy was doing comics, a daily strip was, that was a step. There's Kniff and there's Alex Raymond. You're getting me from comics. That was great. And the pay was a little better. You see, it was interesting. I wouldn't have mind doing it, but some of them do it, and it just gets to be a bore after a while. You know, you have to do it day in and day out.
Did you feel restrained by either the deadlines or the format?
Well, the format was very simple. In a daily, you had the first panel is usually a recap of like a soap opera is what happened the last chap, and then the last two. And they stayed pretty much the same, you know. The only liberty I had, they gave me the script, and I interpreted. I followed, say, if someone was going to shoot somebody or as an ambush, I would visualize it the way I wanted it, that sort of thing. I went to D.C., you know, and I did some advertising, and I started on Gangbusters.
Who are the editors you worked for at D.C.?
The first one I worked for was Murray Boltonoff. With him, I did most of the work, Congo Bill, Tomahawk, Daniel Boone. I did a lot of romance stories. There was some of the good work in that romance stories. Well, those are the main things I did until they came along with Aquaman. And I started the whole series, like book one and two. The others were specialties that they showed, showcases, something like that. And then from there, I went to Teen Titans. After Teen Titans, they got the idea for Batlash. And Batlash I enjoyed. My work changed toward the end of Aquaman. It got a lot looser. While I was doing Aquaman, I was also doing Teen Titans. So I think there were bi-monthlies, I'm not sure. Toward the end, I think the work I can say, I like this. Maybe out of 20 covers, I would say I'd like one. But that Batlash was fun. I worked with Eric Arnus and Giordano and Carmine Infantino. Did you like the Batlash?
I even remember the cover. Remember the wanted poster with the blue.
That was a showcase. Yeah, that was first.
But one of the covers I loved the most was the snow one. The one in the
tombstone.
Snow. Yeah,
Well, that's the story I wrote. That was the one where this little girl gets shot. I like that. But some felt that I put too much humor in it. From what I read in the articles, I didn't know this at the time, but I think the suggestion was that to have it straight and keep the humor in the dialogue. But I've heard no complaints. Everybody liked it so far. So apparently I must have done something right.
I mean, you said you wrote the Batlash story. Did you write many of the stories that you worked on?
No, that was the only one. I try to make him a rugged, old-time Ronald Coleman type. Not look like him, but a cowboy with the smooth talk with the ladies, you know, and this little kid, just when he gets to the point where he's going to kiss the girl, this little kid comes up and says, Daddy, and this girl says, you didn't tell me you were married, and smacks him on the head and goes off, you know. I used to like Laurel and Hardy when I was a kid, and so I did a takeoff on Laurel and Hardy, but I didn't make Laurel look like Laurel. I gave him more of a hook nose, but the other one had the derby. But I gave him that slapstick, that funeral box thing where they're trying, that sort of thing. And that was fun. Or the one that people thought was really slapstick, which it was, when the sheriff was taking a bath in his tub and they're chasing Batlash and he leaps over this guy going through the window. And as he leaps, it's like you're leaping over a fire hydrant, you know. He pushed the sheriff down and went out the window. And then the sheriff forgot his guns, and these guys start shooting through the doors, and he started shooting. You know, it's that sort of slapstick type thing.
Did you get a kick out of the diversity of the strips you were doing in the early 50s when you first went to DC? Because there's a lot of stuff. Alex Toth said he really liked working on romance books because it was the one thing where you got to show emotion and you could really spend time working on it.
With the romance. You could get nice, dramatic, beautiful poses. You could get the shadows. You could take a romance, which is a very dry sort of thing, and you could build it up, add the momentum through the different panels, either by shading or by close-ups, or you develop it. It's like a piece of music. For the big bang, you lead up to it. You know what I mean? And that was good. But the favorites, three of my favorites were the Brave and Bold with the Black Canary, Brave and Bold with the Shroud, where they're in London fog or something. And another one was with the Teen Titans, the Rebels in the Street or something like that. That was all shadows, you see, where in Aquaman and Teen Titans, sometimes I got shadows. When I look back, some of it doesn't look too bad. So the earlier ones, I had a lot of tickling in it. Tickling, I mean, is a lot of little detail. later on, I just made simple lines, and that's what I loved about Alex Toth's work. He was a master. I think he was fantastic. I think he was one of the greats, one of a kind, including Kirby and Neil Adams. I like Neil Adams' work. I love Kirby's work. This guy was an individualist. He was, he'll take a scene, he'll simplify it, get rid of all stuff that wasn't unnecessary, beautiful design. It took guts. He would put black over half a panel and put the tiny figures in the corner. If I showed that to my editor, he says, what's all this black space, you know?
Got to fill up the panel. Yeah. I know everyone wants to fill up the panel.
There's one story where Mike Sikowski was a very difficult person to understand, but we got along. I was delivering a job to Murray Boltonoff, and Mike Sikowski came in, and he just delivered a 24-page story. And Murray Boltonoff looked at it and says, geez, Mike, this is the awfulest stuff I've ever seen. I said, you rushed it. He says, well, he said, you wanted it in a hurry. See, so then he gave him another script. He says, look, take your time on this. See, at about that time, Mike Sikowski had gotten married. So I was invited to his house for, dinner or something. And on the shelf, there were the 24 pages that were finished. I says, when did you finish that? He says, a couple of days ago. And he says, I'm holding it for a week. You see, then he's going to take it to Murray Boltonoff. So I was there when he took it to Murray Boltonoff, see. And I was waiting for a reaction. When Murray Boltonoff looked at them, he said, gee, Mike, now isn't that much better? He took the same amount of time. So. But I always, when I think of that poor guy, he really...
Sikowski apparently was very fast.
Oh, he was fast. I think he was in the Kirby school. They had a system of how he drew an arm or how he drew the drapes on the trousers, on the leg. And every one of them had the same format. And he had it as if a mental printout on what to be done. With me, I had a struggle with the figures all the time. You know, this angle isn't right. The balance in the body isn't right. But everything he did, it was very easy to ink if I had to ink it.
As you look at Sickles' work, especially on Scorchy Smith, it's the most efficient line ever.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I knew Noel Sickles. His early work didn't influence me that much. His later work, the thing that he did for Reader's Digest, the little things with magic markers, he had a feeling of line that I used instead of a lot of shadows. In Batlash, you see a lot of thick and thin lines, you know. And I figured I'd try it. It depends. If there were shadows, I made shadows. But no, he was great. A lot of the new artists, I don't mean to tear them down. They're very competent, you see, and they're good artists. But we used to have a form of design, and these fellows have a form of design. Now, say, for example, you have a figure here in front. Then you're going to show buildings in the background that would be this way. A lot of them, what they do, anything that's in the background, they usually give their blacks in the background the same value as the ones in front. It doesn't fall back. You see what I mean? It comes close, or they have a shadow. A shadow would run into another shadow. Therefore, on some of them, you have to look for the drawing, even though it's beautifully done. It doesn't have the simplicity of a design like a Toth would do it or a Degas would do it. The form is there, you see. And that disturbs me because they have so much talent. It's just one or two little things that the illustrators used to say, give a lot of air around the figures or make sure there's a depth. Things in design, it's like, I don't know if you're familiar with Beethoven music or anything like that. They have a soft movement. They have a loud movement. Then they have the wind up. But everything is built. If it have a three-note thing, that three-note would be repeated throughout. When things go too scattered, you can't concentrate on a story because basically what it is telling a story. And you're a movie director, and you're trying to put your pictures in their minds. You don't want it to be a series of single illustrations. You want it to be a story that follows, you see. And that's the basic thing.
It's interesting you say that because, particularly the Italian filmmakers, use color and tone and light to help tell the dramatic end of the story.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to influence coloring at all in any of your books?
No, I didn't, because there's a lot of them I would have liked to. Oh, incidentally, this guy, Alan René, was a fan of mine. He came up to see me, and Fellini. He's the only guy I ever saw that looked exactly like me. I figured, God, there can't be two of us on the same planet. No, it's nice, because I got to doing storyboards later on, see, for advertising and...
a couple of the editors you worked for. Did you work for Julius Schwartz at all?
I did some work with Julie Schwartz on Superman, I think. I never drew the Superman in the book. I just mainly the covers. But the covers were pretty much controlled by Carmine Infantino. But Carmine loved my work so much that he gave me free rein to design. That's why the Aquaman covers toward the end were different, where I'd have the logo on the bottom. We'd have the stalagmites, you know, and he's standing on that. And in the old days, you can do that, see. So
nice. Things changed a lot, when Carmine came in as publisher.
I had a lot more freedom. In fact, Julie tells a story. He said, the thing I remember about you is that you had delivered a cover. It was in my office, and Carmine was there. Carmine says, Nick, this isn't the cover I designed. And I supposedly said, this is a better cover. And Carmine said, you're fired. And so then whatever happened, I went outside or something. Then Julie Schwartz says, Carmine, who are you going to get to do your covers now? He says, all right, call Nick back. But Carmine and I always got along fine.
But, I mean, did you have any interaction with any of the kind of...
The other comic artists?
Yeah. I mean, did you... Well, I mean, basically freelance from kind of...
I was always freelance. And the only way I met the fellas was if we happened to cross paths while we were delivering jobs. And that's the way I talked to Toth, Cubit, and all the other fellas, you know, and that's how we got to know each other. But some of them socialized. I think... Cubit knew Carmine and a few of the groups, they went together, you know. And no, I didn't. I just went in, did my job, came back. I looked at their work, but there wasn't any comic people that influenced me. It was mainly the art directors that influenced me from the movies. Remember that movie, And Then There Were None, where they got on a boat and one scarf blows, the smoke blows. And he had a beautiful way of leading people into the story, through the characters, into the stories. That was my meat. And if I wanted any polish in my drawing, I would look toward the illustrators, not the cartoonists, you see.
Did you ever see any of the stuff that you actually did storyboards for materialize as a commercial or as a...
Oh, I worked for several companies, and I did one for Match Belly. I did one series of drawings that made me feel like a vivisectionist. It was an animatic type thing where they take the camera and they take one shot and they move the picture up and they take another shot. So I had to do Lily Tomlin and one for Peter Sellers. Lily Tomlin was supposed to be the little girl part. You remember that scene she always played? I had to draw a face and two sets of eyes, one open and one closed, two different mouths that were separate. One was smiling, one was ready to eat a chip, and another one where the chip goes in. Then I had to have two arms, one coming up with the potato chip where they do it. If I sneezed while I was drawing, those pieces would have gone all. I had all these cut out pieces on a piece of paper and I handed them to you. And that was nerve-wracking.
Did you play with paper dolls when you were a kid?
Jesus, that's what worried me when I was doing this here. Yeah, where'd that arm go? You know, you look at papers. You know.
So do you paint now?
Oh, yeah. I did some Western paintings that were in a gallery in Texas for a while. They were about 24 by 36. And they were a Western scene where this... A soldier is fighting with an Indian, and they're going off a cliff. But I went to West Point. I got all the reference on the costumes, on the Indians, things. My paintings were as good as or better than some of the old ones, you see. The only thing, I was a newcomer.
Do you think that you've learned more about story than you would have if you had been a fine artist?
Well, it's a complete different field. Fine artist is concentrating on one picture. This is a concentration of 24 pages, and you had to spread that picture so it makes a general theme of what you're doing. So you have a lot of pictures. You know, in a symphony, you have movements, first movement, second movement. This has 24 movements. You have pages, you know. And sometimes, in those days, when I started, they were restricted to 6 panels on a page, square. Then later on, somebody stuck a foot out of a frame. Then later on, they put the whole foot out, you know. And then they started stretching the frames. They tilted them. They spread them across 2 pages, you see. Then they started getting a little more liberal.
Are there any characters or stories that you would have liked to have done that you hadn't done?
I did Daniel Boone. I got satisfaction of the backgrounds and the scenery and the costumes. I always did a lot of research. And That was one generation. You'd like to do that for a little while, but then enough's enough. And then I'd like to do Aquaman, but that was too much after a while, you know. Then the Teen Titans was one. First of all, I didn't care too much. I'm committing sacrilege, but I never cared too much for Men in Long Underwear, you know, the costumes were. I liked straight illustration. That's why I like the Brave and Bold, because I could get Black Canary and a beautiful girl in a dress without a costume and have a good-looking guy, Batman, before he's in his costume, and you could have nice shadows, and that was illustrating, because that led me to my goal, you see. And that's when I got into illustration. That's a different story, if you want.
Well, Teen Titans, too, you gotta remember all the costumes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a lot of costumes. Even now, after I stayed away from comics for about 20 years. Then when I came back and somebody said, could you draw Mira? I says, I don't know what the costume looks like. I have to get, even now when I'm out there, I'm drawing something, I have to get the costume to see if I do it right, you know?
You come back to it, and all these people at the convention. What, I mean, what do you think of this world?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I was looking as comics as a stepping stone to going into illustration. Then when I did go into illustration, it was all right, but the people that remembered me were the ones from comics. And I was saying, well, this is a step up the ladder. This is more, you know, art. And I started just pushing away from comics. But then I found out my real friends were in the comic, see? So I did it about face, you know. See? But
could have been a timing thing.
Oh, yeah.
The golden age of illustration really was in the 20s, 30s.
Oh, yeah, 40s. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there aren't that many magazines that did print illustration anymore.
At the time I started getting interested in illustration, they started going into using a lot of photographs. But I got into the movie poster. I had a couple of agents that were taking me. I did jobs for Volkswagen and all the way up and down the ladder. In illustration, they have maybe about 300 or 400 artists that are top illustrators. The majority of them use Baloptigans to enlarge a photograph. They reproduce that photograph. I figured my odds as a newcomer was very difficult. So I loved humor, and there weren't too many. So by the time I concentrated on humor, I was bucking maybe 175, 100 people that were in the humor field. See, so my odds were a little better. I did quite a few. I did one for Meatballs 2. My first movie poster was called The Street Fighter, and it was a karate thing. I did a lot of work on that, but it was a lot of violent stuff. But then the guy says, we want to show some blood. I said, I never showed blood. I fought like mad because in the movie, this guy, the hero, actually tears a guy's throat right out. You see, I'm not going to show that, you know. But then I did put a little trickle of blood. Then they had a write-up in some artist magazine about the violence, and they showed that painting.
During the 20 years that you were not involved with the comic book business, you think to yourself, you know, this illustration's for the birds, I'm going to go back to comic.
No, I tell you, because each illustration was a different assignment. The others had repetition. There I felt I'm starting like I did with comics. Now that I'm working illustration, I'm trying to improve it. And there were a lot of good guys out there, Jesus. But when I did the thing for Big Bertha, I met the girl that was the actual model for this. She was on 57th Street in New York City. I walked by and I said, oh, Kitty, I know you. She said, who are you? I said, I did the poster for the first. She said, that's the best part of the whole movie. And I said, I want you to know that I didn't get paid for it yet. And she says, I want you to know we didn't get paid for it yet, the actors, you see. So then when I did another job for New Line, they owed me over $900 that they didn't pay. So I took them to small claims court. Finally, they started giving me money. Then they came along. They said, we want you to do the Bad News Bears. And I figured, oh, this is another one of these jobs, you know. And I said, no. Then I found out Jack Davis did it. And I think he was getting about $5,000 for it. The way they used to do it in the movie posters was that they get three artists that are humorous artists, or one or two, and they get you to paint the whole thing. And they'll pay you, say, it varies according to the artist. If Bob Peake did it, it would be $30, you know, something. And if they select yours, then they would double the price. And you get that. But to me, the biggest honor was when I was doing a poster. I did some for Apocalypse Now. And I did another one for some other company. The originals are on the floor. And right alongside me was Bob Peake and a few of the other guys. I said, geez, I made it. I don't care if they sell the poster. I'm right competing with Bob Peake. Well, he always got it. But it was a good feeling to know that.
Sometimes Bernie Fuchs gets it.
Oh, yeah. Bernie Fuchs, Bob Peake, and a few Coconuts, a few of the others, you know, that... They were great, great, great artists.
You enjoyed everything that you've done in the business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel more of an enjoyment now because I find that other artists who I respect like my work, and the newer artists said that I influenced them, and that's a big plus. I figured maybe I did something right. You know, when Neil Adams come up to me like during the award, he says, during the war, I think I mentioned something, and I didn't think anybody remembered it. Neil Adams said, "Don't worry, Nick. A lot of people remember you." And he says, "You're one of my favorite artists." And another guy comes along and said, "You were this," and Charlie Vest came up and said, "You know." So you get people that you respect that say that they like your work. That's a reward enough, you know. So that made me feel good.